It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to a researcher from the Urban Institute about a new study on the Milwaukee Police Department's use of body cameras.
First, if you've ever turned on C-SPAN and tried to watch proceedings on the House or the Senate floor, you may have noticed it can be hard to follow what's going on.
Take this morning, for instance. Here's the clerk reading House Resolution 656. It has to do with the designation of wilderness, recreational, and conservation areas in three western states.
The committee amendment in the nature of a substitute shall be considered as read. All points of order against the committee amendment in the nature of a substitute are waived. No amendment to the committee amendment in the nature of a substitute shall be in order except those printed in Part C of the report of the Committee on Rules accompanying this resolution.
It went on like that for 7.5 minutes. As we've heard so often in TV infomercials, there's got to be a better way.
Our next guest has some ideas on how to make congressional activity more interesting and relevant to viewers. And he says that could help Congress rebuild the public's trust. Rick Shapiro is a management consultant for both Republican and Democratic members of Congress. He's a former executive director for the Congressional Management Foundation and a senior fellow and consultant for the Democracy Fund. He wrote a piece recently in The Hill about how to make Congress more engaging. Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
You write that Congress has a reputation problem. A lot of polls back that up. Do you think that the sort of boringness of Congress is contributing to that?
I do. I think it is an important contributor. I think the public generally is very frustrated with gridlock and dysfunction in Congress. But they're also, I think, very frustrated by the inaccessibility, which was demonstrated beautifully by the by the tape you played at the start of the program about who could possibly understand what was being articulated by that person. And for a viewer, for a citizen who wants to be more engaged and more interested and more knowledgeable about Congress so they can vote and be informed, how do they make sense of that? And the answer is they can't. And if they can't, what do they do? And of course, we know the answer is they turn off the television or turn something else on, and they miss the opportunity to be a better engaged citizen. And Congress misses the opportunity of partnering with them.
And these are rules of both bodies of Congress that come from a long time ago, before social media or radio or TV, for that matter. Is that part of the problem? It just needs an update?
Well, you know, interestingly, there really aren't that many rules that guide how hearings, congressional hearings, committee hearings occur or floor proceedings occur. There are some, but it's really basically tradition. It's kind of an oral tradition that's been passed down. There's a little bit of rules, but it really would not take any kind of major legislation or change. It would just simply take members of Congress saying, let's try doing this a little bit differently and seeing maybe if this would be more interesting and the public would enjoy this hearing more and get more out of it. And maybe the members of Congress would find it more beneficial. Let's just experiment and try something different. But I think like so many industries, it's just very easy to get locked into your ways. And Congress is working, I think, very hard right now. Particularly, there's a select committee in the House of Representatives on modernizing Congress that's trying to work on improving Congress. But I think issues like this really just simply have missed the radar screen because it is so much of a 200-year tradition. This is the way we did it in 1786 and 1886 and 1986. Why would we change now?
Before we get on to possible solutions, I want to turn to committee hearings. And some of those have been big news over the last year where people put them on the TV. We put them up on public radio here live. You see problems with the way those are run, too.
Well, I do, although some of those blockbuster hearings, you know, the Michael Cohen hearing, the Kavanaugh testimony and so forth. And I mean, those hearings drew millions and millions of Americans. So it demonstrates that Americans want to be involved, want to be engaged, are interested in what Congress does. But unless there is some major drama, they tend to turn off. But what's wrong about those hearings, even though they got a lot of attention, is they're still sticking to a 200-year-old format, which starts with every member of Congress giving a 3 to 5 minute opening statement about the hearing. So if you as a viewer want to watch a hearing, it means that you've got to sit through, if you're going to a House of Representatives hearing where there's 30 or 40 members on the committee, you've got to weigh through 30 or 40 members times 3 minutes apiece before you start hearing questions to the witnesses, the expert witnesses. Who's going to sit around for an hour and a half, 2 hours before the action really starts? So it's just really a slow, dull, tedious format. And then the questions themselves, you have every member of Congress asking questions, but I may ask a question, 4 questions on 3 different topics, and you ask 4 more questions when it comes to your turn on the same 4 topics. And we're just going around and around it, asking the same questions around the same topics. And instead of kind of saying the first 20 minutes of the hearing questions will focus on this topic and then we'll move to the next topic. So it becomes incomprehensible, I think, for most people to watch this and say this is an interesting conversation because it's really 30, 40 individual interviews with 1 or 2 witnesses that are happening, but it's really not programming. It's really not a conversation that's coherent or logical.
Talking to Rick Shapiro from the Democracy Fund, he wrote a piece on the Hill website about ways to make Congress more interesting, engaging for American citizens to watch and to figure out what's going on. Rick, let's get to some of your suggestions. You've got a lot in this piece. You suggest one thing, a bipartisan video where people kind of present an issue, lay out the arguments to start off discussions. What are you envisioning here?
Well, what I'm envisioning is most of the public, if you're doing a hearing on global warming or the need for infrastructure repairs or improving education, any topic, the outbreak of fires in California right now, at some point you want to have kind of a basic introduction to what's going on. What we have right now is an hour to 2 hours of opening statements of members who are essentially playing to the cameras, but nobody's really giving a clear overview. So what I'm looking for is just give the American public 5 to 10 minutes of background, good little video that kind of says, here's the problem, here are the consequences for Americans, objective, not a partisan presentation. Just give everybody a background so we can get into the hearing. Use pictures, use videos, use statistics, use all the media that we have available to us to present a very quick and easy to understand picture so people can get right into the issue, even if they're not really fully knowledgeable of that issue. But it's making the issue accessible to the American public, and it's educating them.
We posted a link to your piece on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rick, Annie comments, explainer videos should be brief and to the point. I would assume almost no esoteric knowledge on the part of the audience for the videos. Maybe repeat at adult levels, knowledge they were probably exposed to as children. So this is, you're looking, does that match up with what you're saying, a one-on-one on whatever the issue is?
Well, I'm really saying that probably I would have the committee staff, minority and majority staff, meaning the Republicans and Democrats, agree on what the 5 or 10 minute video is. Make it simple and straightforward, but clear and understandable so people understand the issue. And make it an easy access road to get into the hearing for people to be interested in saying, oh, I didn't really know much about the subject. Now I've got this nice quick overview, and now I feel I really understand the topic. I'm interested in hearing what more needs to be said. So I agree with Annie, yes, but you know, make it simple, not really for kids, but you know, directly, but certainly accessible to interested kids as well. But give them the basic facts and do what, you know, all good television programming, radio programming does, training programs, et cetera, which is give people the necessary information they need right up front, make it as easy and efficient as possible to download that information so people know how to take the next steps.
One possible objection, your goal here includes the words Congress, Republican, Democrat, and agree. Can both parties actually agree on what should be in an introductory video like this?
You raise a very good point about the collaboration of those words. I think they can, though. I think they're really, if you're basically saying, let's lay out the problem, let's talk about what the problem is, where really Republicans and Democrats tend to disagree is on the solution. How do we solve the problem? But I think agreeing on what the problem is and what its impact is on basic Americans, on cities, on states, on the budgets of cities, et cetera, I think there's generally facts and agreement on those points. So My point is, let's get agreement on the facts up front, and then we can have the hearing where there's discussion of different points of view about what are the resolutions, what are the ways we solve these problems. That's where the disagreement occurs. But it would be also a very good exercise for Republicans and Democrats staff on committees to say, can we agree before a hearing on what are the basic facts and what are the basic consequences and how it impacts Americans today? And just getting that statement up front would both be educational, informative, but would also be a very good bipartisan exercise for the staff and members to be able to agree on what the problem is and how we present it to our voters.
We're talking about how to make congressional activity more interesting and relevant with Rick Shapiro. He's a management consultant who works with both Republican and Democratic members of Congress.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you watch or listen to congressional committee hearings or maybe floor debates? How would you make them more engaging or useful? Do you understand the legalese and all the procedural stuff that's taking place? Or do you get kind of lost? We want to hear your ideas at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Right now, we're talking about how to make Congress interesting again. Our guest says it's time to bring some of the archaic rules and formats back into the 21st century. Our guest is Rick Shapiro. He's a former executive director and now a consultant for the Congressional Management Foundation. And he recently wrote about this for The Hill.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. Have you tried to watch congressional hearings on C-SPAN or listen to the ones that get televised when there's big events? What do you like about them? What frustrates you about them? Do you find it painful and boring to watch? What would you want to change? Call 800-642-1234. Rick, before we go to our callers, let's tackle another one of your solutions. We were talking about committee hearings and how they're kind of narrative train wrecks with this one going, that one going, the topics jumping around. How could that run more smoothly and informatively?
Well, I think what the public is looking for, and I think what members of Congress are looking for, is a meaningful discussion in those hearings. And what we have is a bunch of questions that are being read by members of Congress that are written by their staff. They're obviously asking some of their own questions as well, but it's basically a fairly rote process. What I'm looking for is creating a more robust process where there's a really interesting conversation amongst the expert witnesses, Republicans and Democrats in the hearing room. And why not bring the American public into the conversation? Why not? We have the technology that we didn't have 30 years ago or 20 years ago. Why not let the American public be able to provide calls the same way that you're going to have callers in this show potentially? Create the same opportunity. Let the American public engage in the process and say, this is a fascinating hearing. I'd like to know the answer to the following questions. And let members of Congress be able to talk with each other instead of just simply asking questions of witnesses. Why not make it an interesting problem-solving discussion? And why not create the opportunity for people who are working and can't participate and listen to a hearing at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, come home and listen to a 30-minute podcast or a 30-minute video summary of what happened in a four-hour hearing today. Why not be able to reduce it to 30 minutes and have interested Americans saying, I got a great, wonderful summary of this hearing that I'm interested about. The idea really is build a partnership with the American public. And we now have the technology that we didn't have for most of our 200-plus year history to create a partnership where Americans can watch Congress, can be can hold their members accountable, and be interested and involved in what Congress is doing on a daily basis. But Congress is doing everything it can to discourage us from paying attention, even though we have this wide open access to what Congress is doing and how it's doing it.
You mentioned podcasts, and in your piece, I think you talk about social media. Do you have a vision for ways to engage with the public via whatever form of social media?
I don't. And the ideas I suggest really aren't meant to be, the best ideas. It just the point I really wanted to make was if anybody in the public thinks about what's interesting about program, what do they like about television, what are they like interesting about radio programs or training programs they attend to or whatever, And how does this apply to Congress? I think almost anybody would say, I could make that format more interesting, more enjoyable, more accessible to millions of more Americans. And my point is, why aren't members of Congress doing the same thing and saying, let's be innovative and think about, rather than taking this format that we've adopted and carried forward for 200 years, why not see if we can innovate and improve upon it? And so I could probably play with social media ideas, but I'm sure some of your callers could probably come up with wonderful ideas of, if you saw an interesting idea in a hearing, how could you apply it to a social media format and make it more useful to the American public, and how to make those things go viral and engage more people. The point is, I think there's a wonderful opportunity for Congress and the American public to partner and say, let's figure out how to make the work of Congress more interesting so it better meets the needs of the American public, so you're more interested in it, you find it more interesting and more accessible, and quite frankly, members of Congress find it more interesting and more accessible because they tend to tune out from floor proceedings and committee hearings as well, because they recognize it's basically political theater and it's really not meant to be a useful, serious conversation. They'd love it to be a more serious conversation. The format really doesn't allow for it. And what I'm saying is, then let's change the format.
Rick Shapiro is with us talking about ways to make Congress more interesting. He wrote a piece about this in The Hill. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Iris is with us in Waukesha. Iris, hi.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to say, I think instead of just numbers, they should have to give headings and subheadings, you know, like regarding the sale of the wetlands for, you know, and I really don't think they want to take the time to make it more interesting, because it just flies along like this without any input. They don't have to, you know, accept any input. It's decided already. You know what I mean?
Iris, I gotcha. So Iris is worried that Congress is doing what it wants to do. It doesn't necessarily want the public to be that aware of what they're doing, I guess, Rick.
Yeah, no, actually, if you think about this, and I work with dozens and dozens of House and Senate, Republican and Democratic congressional offices, one of their greatest needs and desires is for every member of Congress is, how do I better connect with my constituents? Because they're my voters. How do I make it appear that I'm really interested in what they're doing? How do I demonstrate my interest? How do I stay closer abreast and engage with their concerns? And they're doing everything they can at their own office level to do this. But I think Iris's point is a very good point, which is, if you ask the clerk of the House or the secretary of the Senate, or the people who are involved in reading, you know, House H.R. 4211 and reading these, you know, the title of the bill and going through this arcane language, has anybody stopped and said, when we started doing this in the 1800s or the late, you know, 1700s, there was nobody paying attention on television or radio, but now they are. And this language is completely inaccessible to the American public. Let's change the language a little bit so viewers can really be knowledgeable, interested, and find watching and understanding Congress something that they enjoy doing. And I don't think anybody's just taken the time to say, how do we make this better? But I agree with you, Iris. There should be more than numbers, and there should be some explanations about what the bill is and what it achieves, what it attempts to do. And there should be, you know, take 20 seconds to give a moment background that would make it a much more engaging proceeding for the American public.
Iris, thanks for the call. We'll go to Rick now with us in Rhinelander. Rick, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, I think the presenter makes a very good case. However, I think Iris makes the important point. There has to be a desire among our legislators to actually want to engage the public. As an example, here in Wisconsin, we never have our elected representatives, for instance, Senator Johnson and Senator Duffy, Representative Duffy, who used to be our representative here in northern Wisconsin, would never have town hall meetings. When I'd call their offices and say, hey, I'd like to engage the representative or the senator, they'd say, well, he's going to have a telephone town hall, which was a, you know, highly selected thing. There were screeners and just simply wasn't an engagement. So there has to be a desire first, which I don't believe exists. And the second point is this, Rick made the point that if you could have Democrats and Republicans agree on objective facts, then they could discuss their policy prescriptions. The reality is we live in a time where we hear things like alternative facts, and there is no truth, as Mr. Giuliani said. And consequently, you hear things that are frankly, falsehoods.
Rick, thanks for the call. Rick Shapiro, what do you think? You could take that wherever you want.
I would agree with the critique. I think it would be a very good exercise for members of Congress and their staff to agree on the facts and say we have to present at the start of the hearing today a set of facts and a general short narrative about this issue. Can we agree on what the facts are? That would be very useful to force Republicans and Democrats to begin the process by saying we need to agree on the facts. I do think, to your other point, I do think that members of Congress are very interested in engaging with the public. They are scared about some of the old formats like town hall meetings, which have been going on for, you know, centuries now, because town hall meetings have been taken over often by organizations, and members are saying, I come to this meeting and I run the risk of being ambushed by, you know, 75 people who are there to simply ambush me and create some kind of bad visual. So a lot of members of Congress have said we're not going to do that because we can't really control the format and ensure that really it is a productive conversation. It's a shame. It's a problem. But this applies to the same thing that I'm talking about other formats. If that's the case, then let's come up with some new formats that members can use back in the district that allows for a much more robust and interesting exchange between constituents and members of Congress and constituents with themselves, because it's really important for constituents, Republicans and Democrats and moderates, to also be talking about these issues, which they really have very few forums to do that. So I agree. I wish more members would do town hall meetings, but I also understand why many of them don't. We need new formats for those as well.
Rick, thanks a lot for that call. In our last few minutes, Rick Shapiro, do you think, as you said, you've worked with people in Congress, you've worked with staff people, is there an appetite to maybe tackle some of these issues, make things more transparent, and bring the public back into the process?
I think there really is. And as I mentioned before, there is something called the House Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress, which was a committee that was created of six Republicans and six Democrats. Who were given a one-year mandate to look at the House and figure out how to modernize processes in the House. And they have been very enthusiastically, and actually one of the members is Representative Pocan from Wisconsin, who's been a very active and effective member. So he is, I think, as well as the other 11 colleagues on the committee, they're working very hard to do this, to try to modernize Congress and bring it up to the 21st century. I think they've gotten dozens and dozens of other members to testify. There's, I think, a lot of interest in moving forward.
And we leave it there. Thanks to Rick Shapiro. You can read more in The Hill. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, believe it or not, Wisconsin does not have an official state cheese. But some state lawmakers want to change that. We'll learn more about the proposal and ask for your nomination coming up.
First, when body cameras were gaining popularity in law enforcement, the idea was to increase transparency.
If someone had an issue with an interaction they had with the police, both they and the officer would, in theory, have a video record of what happened.
But when it comes to the way those body cameras affect the officers who wear them, research is giving us new information all the time.
Dan Lawrence joins us now with a new study. He's a senior research associate with the Urban Institute. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Let's start with the latest research on body cams and the Milwaukee Police Department released this weekend. What have you found?
So the recent study that the Urban Institute conducted was with Milwaukee Police Department, and we conducted a randomized control trial with 504 officers. And we explored a new area of research in the body-worn camera literature, which was analyzing how the cameras affect officers' proactive activities. So the activities that they're not dispatched to, the ones that they have time to self-initiate. And the past research hasn't really explored this area because it hasn't been an area of focus for a lot of police departments. But we wanted to look at how the cameras not only affect the overall amount of proactive activity that officers conduct, but also how the makeup of those activities may change as a result of getting a body-worn camera.
And when you talk about these proactive measures, what does that look like? What kinds of activities are police engaging in?
We looked at four main areas, and it actually accounted for about 85% of the officers' proactive activities.
Oh.
And in this case, it was traffic stops, business checks, subject stops, and park and walks.
And what is a park and walk if I don't know the language?
Sure. So a park and walk is when an officer will park their patrol car and simply just walk around the neighborhood. It's a very community-oriented type of activity. It's meant to get officers out on foot, talk to community members, build rapport with them, learn from them, and just have a very public, positive interaction with community members.
Yeah, we're seeing a push in different communities for community policing. What happened with park and walks in your study? Where did you see the numbers change?
So, interestingly enough, the overall amount of proactive activities didn't change. And that was perhaps not as surprising because these activities are, officers don't really have as much time for these activities because they're constantly responding to dispatch calls or to 911 calls. So the amount of activities not changing was not as surprising, but we did find that the makeup of the activities did change. We saw that in terms of park and walks, those activities, officers who were equipped with a body-worn camera, they actually increased their amount of park and walks by 23% compared to the control group, officers who didn't have the body-worn camera. And we also saw on the other side of that was that there was a large decrease, it was about 8% on average, in the amount of subject stops officers conducted.
And bring us into that. When you talk about subject stops, what does that look like on the street?
So this is in instances where an officer may see an individual that they may know who has a past, a relationship with the police, and they want to follow up on, talk to them, or even if there's a warrant for an individual, they could stop them and question them. So it's in instances where a community member is walking on the street and the officer initiate to stop and prevents them from continuing their business and they just have to interact with the officer. So in generally, it's a negative interaction from the perspective of a community member.
So we could see how this might be seen as a positive or a negative. I mean, it might concern people that police are less likely to engage in these sorts of interactions if they're wearing a body camera, because then they might be less likely to catch people breaking the law. How do you respond to that?
In my opinion, I mean, I see these as pretty positive results for implementing body-worn cameras with police departments. We find that officers may be becoming more hesitant to engage in the activities that could result in negative interactions with the public. As I was previously mentioning, subject stops are not, no community member wants to go through a subject stop. It's not something that they are, that they want to have happen to them. So there's a increased chance of a negative encounter or possibly a citizen complaint developing from a subject stop. So officers doing this type of or reducing this type of activity is a good thing from a community perspective. And they're also increasing those positive community-oriented behaviors, which are parks and walks, so going out into the community and speaking more with community members and seeing them. So this is overall a positive thing for improving police community relations.
Is it fair to say that supporters might argue that the research shows that police are less likely to bother people who aren't doing anything wrong? Is there a point there?
I don't understand the question.
Right. When if they're doing fewer subject stops, they're less likely to be encountering people or engaging with them all the time. So, the fact that somebody has a previous record doesn't mean they're doing anything wrong today. Maybe it's just less of a bother, less of an opportunity even for profiling.
Sure. So in the case of subject stops, there's an enforcement aspect to it. So a stop and frisk could be involved in a subject stop, or when a person doesn't want to willingly be involved with the police. But the other side is the parks and walks, which could have a community interaction with a community member. So there are aspects of parks and walks where the officers are speaking to community members, are learning from them and building rapport with them. So more generally a positive type of community behavior.
Dan Lawrence is a senior research associate with the Urban Institute, and we're talking about research that deals with body cams and the Milwaukee Police Department. Dan, just having a body camera program in a department can have an effect on those subject stops, those interactions, even if the officer isn't wearing a body cam. Is that right?
So in terms of we also looked at a number of other things, but the officers who had a didn't have a body cam, we looked at comparing them to officers who did, and we found that there are other aspects where officers don't change their behavior. So traffic stops didn't change. The number of arrests didn't change. We also saw that business checks, going into a business and talking to the business owner, those aspects didn't change. But we did find the reduction in subject stops and the increase in parks and walks.
And how does that fit into some past research that you've done when it comes to body cameras and how would they affect police in other factors?
Sure. So we looked at things like use of force, officers who were involved in a use of force incident. We also found in that case that the number of body-worn camera or the having a body-worn camera didn't impact officers who were involved in a use of force incident. And early findings in this field of research found large decreases to officers' use of force incidents when they were equipped with body-worn cameras. But more recent studies that are larger and a little bit more rigorous on the methodologies are finding similar things where use of force, body-worn cameras have no impact on use of force.
So stepping way back, big picture, when might we be able to say whether body cameras are good for policing or for the public?
Well, I just wanted to caution that body-worn cameras aren't a panacea for improving transparency and accountability or even fixing police community relations. They're just a single tool that needs to be used in conjunction with other policies and interventions to actually have an impact on police practice. But that being said, we're seeing that body-worn cameras are positively impacting both community and officer perspectives in terms of having officers being able to record interactions from their perspective. It's pretty common where officers, especially Milwaukee officers and with the many that we spoke to in the city, they go to a scene and they find that the community members who might not be directly related to the incident are pulling out their cell phones and recording them. So officers, when we first talked to them, they had some concern that the body-worn cameras are an additional hassle and might hurt other aspects of their work, but they found that they were becoming more comfortable with the technology and found that it really benefited the work that they do.
We'll pay more attention as we go forward. Dan, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
That was Dan Lawrence, a senior researcher with the Urban Institute. He was with us to talk about the latest study looking at the effects of body cameras in the Milwaukee Police Department.
Coming up, Colby could become the official cheese of Wisconsin. We'll take your calls on that proposal at 800-642-1234. Do you think Colby should become the state cheese, or would you make the case for another one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the timber industry is just one area that took a big hit from a massive windstorm in July of this year. We talk with a journalist covering that storm's wide-ranging impacts.
Now, Wisconsin is known for its wide array of dairy products, from ice cream to milk to, yes, you guessed it, cheese. Despite the state's long history and love affair with cheese, we actually don't have an official state cheese.
That could change, though, if lawmakers get their way. Colby, the mild cheddar-like cheese developed in Colby, Wisconsin, could join the ranks of official state symbols in the Wisconsin Blue Book. Items include things like cranberries, our official state fruit, and polka, the official state dance.
And we want to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234. What do you think about Colby potentially becoming the state cheese? If you're not on board, what would you pick instead? Also, if you're a Colby fan, tell us your favorite ways to use the cheese. Call in now, 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll take your calls coming up in just a few moments. First, we talked to one of the lawmakers who's spearheading the bill, Senator Kathleen Burns. Bernier is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 23rd Senate District. That includes Chippewa Falls, Senator Bernier, welcome to Central Time.
You are very welcome.
All right, we have a lot of cheese we make here in Wisconsin. Why Colby as the state cheese?
Well, Colby is the only cheese that was developed by a Wisconsin resident. So I think it's a very important cheese, number one. Number two, it is probably the most popular cheese. It's got a light flavor. It's chewy. It is sold around the world and is a very, very good cheese. And so Wisconsin, Colby was developed in Wisconsin.
We already have cheese as the state dairy product. Some people might say, okay, why do we need a particular state cheese at all?
Well, I think we are known for our cheeses. Obviously, that's what actually makes us a dairy state. So I can empathize with that argument. However, you know, when you have a constituent who writes you a letter and encourages you to do something, and you think, well, it seemed quite reasonable. So cheese is important to our state. I think Colby should be really recognized as the cheese that put Wisconsin on the map.
A while back, there was an effort, I don't think this happened, to make lactobacillus, key in cheese making, our state microbe. Is there any hope of that making a comeback?
I am not aware of that. So if I'm not aware of it, probably not.
Probably not then. Okay.
Okay.
It's a fun conversation to talk about designating new state things. But in this case, is there an economic development angle here? Just another way to put Wisconsin cheese literally on the map. You're near Colby, Wisconsin itself.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to recognize Wisconsin's uniqueness as far as cheese is concerned. And, you know, I understand we make cheddar and sharp cheddar and Gouda and all of the different types of cheeses. But Colby was purchased, I'm not sure you know, by Kraft. So when my children were young, I took them on a field trip to Jim Falls Dairy, which is now AMPI, and they exclusively made Colby cheese. 29% of all of the Colby cheese is made in the state of Wisconsin, but the demand is so high, or 21%, and 79% is made in other areas of the country to satisfy the need and the want for Colby cheese. So it's a big deal, and I think when you recognize how popular Colby cheese is, I think Wisconsin should be very proud of that.
Senator Bernier, thanks so much for taking a few minutes today.
You are welcome.
That was Republican State Senator Kathleen Bernier of Chippewa Falls. She joined us to talk about a new proposal that would make Colby the official state cheese of Wisconsin.
And we're taking your calls now about the move at 800-642-1234. The number again is 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
And you can also join in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We already heard there from Amber, who says, Colby is the best, and I love it. It has my vote, LOL. I think that was, I mean, she's laughing, but I think she's sincere in her love of Colby. How about you join in at 800-642-1234?
You know, my cousin is probably not going to vote for Colby. She goes to college in Manhattan, and I texted her for a favor the other day, and her response was, as long as I'm paid in sharp cheddar cheese.
Only sharp cheddar, okay.
So, Colby might have some contenders up there that might be fighting for that top spot of Wisconsin's, you know, state cheese.
We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Viroqua. Tim, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Colby hot or not, Tim?
Definitely on the cold side. Colby's kind of the bland blob of cheeses. I think we could do a lot better. Wisconsin's full of gold medal cheeses that would much better represent our skills. Upland Cheese's Pleasant Reserve would be a great cheese. Organic Valley just won a gold with their blue cheese. Lots of better choices than blah Colby.
Tim, thank you so much for that call. I appreciate it. I got to say, when I was a kid, I like Colby a lot, but I liked him. There's just so much good stuff out there that Colby doesn't usually find its way into my shopping cart anymore.
I mean, is it Colby? Could it be Colby Jack? Could it be Colby Mist with other things?
You know, I like Kojak in a taco.
Okay, sure. There we go. That'll work. But I would say blah is kind of a fighting word.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to make some enemies there. You were looking for your calls, 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Fred with us in La Crosse. Fred, hi.
Hi there. I haven't met a cheese I don't like, but I think the state cheese should be Limburger, because the only place in the United States that makes Limburger cheese is in Wisconsin, just outside Monroe.
Now, Fred, Limburger has a reputation, I think mostly from the cartoons, where Limburger was like this devastating smell that would drive away Bugs Bunny or whatever. Are you a Limburger fan yourself?
Sure, and you don't eat it with your nose.
Good point, Fred. I've got some foods in my house that I have to explain that to my family, too. They smell terrible, but taste really good. Fred, thanks so much for that call. Limburger might be an uphill battle in the state legislature, though.
I'm thinking so. You know, this is an opportunity for the different parties to come together in the state. I think that's good, but we should have some parameters for the state cheese. I mean, is it the best cheese? Is it the cheese that's made here? Is it the tastiest?
I just feel like here.
Right, yeah. We don't have enough of a rubric to really understand what would make a good state cheese for Wisconsin.
State lawmakers are looking to make Colby, some of them anyway, looking to make Colby the official state cheese of Wisconsin. We're taking your calls. Do you like that idea? Do we need a state cheese? If so, do you want Colby or something else? And you tell us what that something else is. 800-642-1234. Todd joins us next in De Pere. Todd, hi.
Hi. Just a comment on the Colby. I think Colby is kind of on the bland side. No offense to anyone. I think there's so much better cheeses out there. Perhaps maybe the first cheese that was commercially sold, which I'm not aware of, or a cheese that has won the most awards. A type of cheese. And one last comment is, if there was only one cheese I could pick from, if I stranded on an island, it'd have to be a well-aged cheddar.
I was thinking, Todd, if you polled my family, aged cheddar might be a winner for the state cheese of Wisconsin. Do you have a year preference?
3 years and older, and well, the older the better.
Can we just pause to recognize that Todd was like, if I could only pick one cheese to have on a deserted island, like that's so Wisconsin. Like,
right.
Todd is here with us.
And hopefully we've got refrigeration or a cave maybe on the island to keep the cheese
an
for
island
a long
cave.
Time.
Yes.
We've got time for another caller or two at 800-642-1234. Your nominations for the state cheese. Colby is in the running. What do you think? Steve is with us in Highland. Steve, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think, Steve?
Well, my pick would be cheddar, and I looked up the pounds sold, and cheddar has 500 and some million pounds sold compared to Colby, which has 80 million pounds sold in Wisconsin. So cheddar is far more popular throughout the state. It certainly tastes better. I think Colby tastes like wet cardboard.
And which one is most popular with you, Steve? Is it the cheddar?
Oh, cheddar, and three-year-old at least. Nice, right. Sharp cheddar.
All right. The aged cheddar movement is picking up steam. You can keep letting us know what cheese you want to be the official state cheese of Wisconsin over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
It sounds like from the blog Eat Like No One Else, we understand that Colby is different than cheddar because of how it's made, that you wash the Colby curds first, and so that makes it milder when you make the cheese. So maybe some of these cheddar fans are just not giving Colby enough of a chance. Maybe they need a little something mild in their life.
Maybe. You can, again, keep letting us know your favorite cheese. Go ahead and vote on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, cheese is already the state dairy product, the official state dairy product. Lactobacillus, as I mentioned earlier, it was in the running to be the state microbe. It isn't. You can let us know what you think of that idea, too. Are you getting hungry for cheese, Keeley?
I mean, if I said no, I wouldn't be a true Wisconsinite, right?
Uh-huh.
But Greg from La Crosse says cheese curds should just be the state cheese. So it doesn't matter variety, but really the presentation, the kind of cheese.
Yeah, I mean, cheese curds are very popular. Do you go fried or, you know, raw and squeaky?
Squeaky. I think that's a good question.
Yeah, I would... I'll admit this. I'm not a big squeaky cheese curd guy. I like a good fried curd every now and then. I think I might, you know, if you force me to make a vote here, I think I would go for an aged cheddar to be the official cheese of Wisconsin.
You're on the record now. I mean, you can't take that back now that you've said it is an aged cheddar. So if Colby passes, what are you going to do about that, Ferret?
I'll live with it. Thank you so much for all of your calls. Keep letting us know your favorite cheese and what you want to see the state cheese of Wisconsin. You can keep that going. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. It's almost time to change clocks. It often sneaks up on you right around the time of Halloween. Daylight saving time will end early Sunday morning. You might switch your clocks earlier than that. End daylight saving time, then we get, Keely, a bonus hour. That's always pretty exciting, right? Everybody's happy and excited about that extra hour.
Okay, but...
Except
the downer side to this is that as soon as I get the new hour, I just start thinking about the spring when I lose an hour anyway. So I understand that it seems like it's a gain, but it all evens out in the end. And I just feel that sense of dread.
But that lost hour is months away. Why does it hang over your head like that?
I'm not really sure. I feel like as soon as we get this great thing, I can't enjoy how wonderful it is because it will be equaled out. I mean, it's not a net negative, of course, but I don't know. Something about even the moving back throws off everybody's schedule in my house.
It does. I can see that, especially with kids around. Do you have plans for how to spend that extra hour?
I mean, I just realized it today when you mentioned it, so I'm going to have to figure it out soon because they're not going to wake up later just because the clock says a different time.
All right. We give you an extra hour for free here on Central Time. Don't blame us when the one gets taken away in the spring, though. You're listening to the Ideas Network.